This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Thank you for coming by the studio, Jalal. Could you tell us a little bit about the origins of Last Poets?
Well, we started on the corner, and we finished on the square.
And what was it that you were out to do?
We was out to bring something to get some.
And what kind of resistance did you run into?
Opposition and superstition.
The reaction of the record companies? What do you think about them?
The record companies are the pimp, the artists are the hoe, the stage is the corner, and the audience is the trick.
Radio, critics, newspapers?
Newspapers, radios, TV, spreading lies across the seven seas.
Did you have any kind of problems from the government or government agencies?
Well, the government is to govern you men. They govern you men.
Oh, my people, what is your worth? What is your worth? What is your worth? Child of the earth. Oh, my people,
oh, my people, oh, my people,
what is your worth?
Oh, my people, oh, my people,
what is your worth?
Oh, my people,
what is your worth?
Oh, my people,
child of the earth.
Oh, my people, oh, my people,
are you like silver?
Oh, my people,
yeah.
Oh, my
diamonds or gold?
Oh, my people, oh, my
increasing in value.
Oh, my people, oh, my people,
as you grow old.
Oh, my people, oh, my people,
or are you like dew?
Oh, my people,
at the start of the day.
Oh, my people,
like smoke in the wind. Like smoke in the wind, slowly fading away.
Oh, my people,
you can't be measured.
Oh, my people,
yeah. And dollars and cents.
Oh, my people,
you can only be measured.
Oh, my people,
in your deeds and intent.
Oh, my people,
and what you achieve.
Oh, my people,
and how you relate.
Oh, my people.
What are your virtues?
Oh, my people.
And if you are great,
oh, my people,
just tell me, why are you here?
Oh, my,
why are you here in this degraded old state?
Oh, my people,
a victim of scorn, a victim of scorn, contempt and of hate.
Oh, my people, oh, my people,
why can't your hearts be,
oh, my people,
yeah, oh, my united as one? For a cause such as freedom, for the future to come.
Oh, my people, oh, my people.
What kind of veils, 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 veils hide your eyes from the truth?
Oh, my people,
why do you not research? Why do you not research and establish the proof?
Oh, my people,
of where you have come from.
Oh, my people, yeah.
And what was your way?
People, oh,
let's find
people,
some solution,
oh, my people,
for the moral decay.
Oh, my people,
that brightens our elders,
oh, my people,
and shatters our homes.
Oh, my people,
abandoning our offspring,
oh, my people,
to a fate of their own.
we must rise up, my people.
Oh, my people, yeah.
From the depths of our dust.
Oh, my people.
To a new understanding.
Oh, my people.
Built on mutual trust.
Oh, my people.
To some solid achievements.
Oh, my people, yeah.
And a new way of life.
Oh, my people.
Bringing into the conflicts.
Oh, my people.
And the internal strife.
Oh, my people.
That plagues our existence.
Oh, my people, yeah.
And threatens our end.
Oh, my people.
We must define our enemy.
Oh, my people.
And just who is our friend.
Oh, my people.
And then my people.
Oh, my people, yeah.
And only then.
Oh, my people.
Can we rise up our heads. Among the nations of men.
Oh, my people.
Oh, my reclaiming people. Our birthright.
Oh, my people, yeah.
Reasserting people. Our pride.
Oh, my people.
Reuniting oh, my people. Our families.
Oh, my people.
Oh, my increasing people. Our stride.
Oh, my people.
Oh, my new people. Rules of our choosing.
Oh, my people, yeah. Oh, my
new
people.
Goals to attain.
Oh, my people.
One God, one destiny,
oh,
one God,
people.
One destiny,
oh,
one people,
people,
one aim.
Oh my people, oh,
and
my people.
All my people,
oh my people, yeah.
What
oh,
a wonderful people. Day.
Oh my people, oh,
when
my
we people. Use our talent,
oh my people,
in a positive way.
Oh my people, oh,
my providing people. Ourselves,
oh my people, yeah.
With
oh,
the things that we need.
Oh my people, oh my
purging
people.
Our systems.
Oh my people,
oh my of enmity and greed.
Oh my people,
oh my reshaping people. Our image.
Oh my people,
emerging as one.
Oh my people,
setting my righteous people. Examples.
Oh my people,
for the children people. To come.
Oh my people, oh
then maybe my people.
Oh my people, yeah.
Just maybe you'll find
oh my people,
some joy that's been hidden
oh my people,
in your space and time
oh my people, yeah.
And in your ascent
oh my people,
you'll find that it's true
oh my people.
There is no treasure, no treasure more precious than you.
Oh my people,
oh my people.
People, yeah. Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people. Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people.
Child of the earth.
Oh, my people. Oh, my people.
Well, my people.
Oh, my people. Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people. Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh, my people.
Child of the earth.
Oh, my people.
What is your word?
Oh my people. Oh my people.
What is your word?
Oh my people.
What is your word?
Oh my people.
Child of the earth.
Yeah, good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And that was The Last Poets from a 1984 album called Oh My People, produced by Bill Laswell for Material. And The Last Poets are appearing. They seem to be in town. They're at Rough Trade one day. It might have been last Monday. It might be next Monday. But they're at the British Library tonight with a whole team of other poets. I think Ben Ockery and other people who I cannot now remember. But that is the British Library tonight. I'm going. I don't know if the tickets are still available. And I don't know if there are tickets still available for my film. Next week, May the 24th, Thursday, May the 24th, It's My Own Invention. A new film by me, William English, and starring Hugh de la Cruz, the inventor of perpetual motion, perhaps, And he will be there in person to answer questions about physics and the impossibility or not of perpetual motion at the end of the film. Soundtrack by Dan Wilson. So again, it's at limited tickets. I think it's a small cinema at Southbank University, seats about 35 people. You can go to, if you Google, whatever it is you do, Eventbrite, Resonance, It's My Own Invention, or words to that effect. And that's at Southbank University, May the 24th. I think it starts at 7 o'clock. Okay, so this afternoon, that was The Last Poets. Coming up, we have Spoken Word, Norman Finkelstein, An Issue of Justice, Origins of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, which is one of a set of five CDs on the AK Press. In fact, there are several of these series, all of them spoken word of one sort or another. This one is by Norman Finkelstein, and quote from the CD, if a historian tried to explain the resistance of Native Americans to European encroachment and said that they were motivated by anti-Europeanism, or they were motivated by anti-Christianism, or they were motivated by anti-whitism, people would just laugh, because it was perfectly obvious why Native Americans were resisting European encroachment. They feared territorial displacement and dispossession, and yet something so transparent, so obvious, becomes so obscure and so clouded when you turn to Israel-Palestine. That's a quote by Norman Finkelstein from the CD. So I should be playing chunks of that interspersed with tracks from a double LP called Give Me Love, Songs of the Broken-Hearted, Baghdad, 1925 to 1929. Something by Ruli Shabara, another something on the Rough Guide to the Music of Palestine, which includes an extra, a bonus CD with music by Ramzi Abu Redwan, Reflections of Palestine. And then perhaps a bit of a sidewinder, as Dan would call it, some Guy Debord, Enregistrement Magnétique, 1952 to 1961, what with May 68 and all that. Okay, but let's proceed with some of Norman Finkelstein.
Origins of the Israel-Palestine conflict are usually dated from the end of the 19th century, when the Zionist movement sought to resolve what was called the Jewish question in Europe at the time. And the Jewish question basically had two sides to it, and they were flip sides of the same coin. On the one side was the problem of what was called Gentile simply meaning non-Jewish, Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, the sometimes legal, sometimes physical disabilities that were imposed on Jews in various parts of Europe. There was the problem of Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, and then there was the reverse problem, the problem of Gentile attraction or assimilation. The fear that at least in some parts of Europe, Jews would so successfully assimilate into the countries in which they lived that they would lose their national or cultural or ethnic or religious identity. So you had two problems, the problem of Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, and the problem of Gentile attraction or assimilation. And the Zionist movement proposed its own unique solution to this Jewish question. And the unique solution that it proposed was to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And by a Jewish state, it meant a state which was overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish. After the Zionist movement won the support of a great power for its project, in this case, Great Britain, through the issuance of what was called the Balfour Declaration, once the Zionist movement had won the support of a great power, Its main challenge was the indigenous population, because Palestine at the end of the 19th century was not Jewish, but overwhelmingly Muslim and to a lesser extent Christian Arab. And the Zionist movement understood from the very beginning that there was no way that the indigenous population would acquiesce in the creation of a Jewish state, an overwhelmingly Jewish state, which at best would marginalize the indigenous population and which at worst would result in their expulsion. The Zionist movement recognized that there was no way that there can be a diplomatic, a peaceful resolution of the conflict with the indigenous population, given the goal that they had set for themselves to create an overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish state in an area which was overwhelmingly not Jewish. Given that there was no way for there to be a diplomatic or a peaceful resolution of the conflict, the fact of the matter was there are basically only two alternatives the Zionist movement can choose from. You can, in your minds, conjure up 1,000 different ways to resolve this dilemma, and presumably at these universities with all their courses on conflict resolution, they can probably turn out or churn out 1,000 different theses to resolve this conflict. But in the real world, in the practical world of politics, there were only two choices or options to choose from. And the Israeli historian Benny Morris, who's a very competent historian, politically he's a thug, but as a historian, he's competent. And Benny Morris, in an essay of his, he wrote not too long ago, he said basically the Zionist movement could choose between only one of two options. And he defined the options as follows. One, he called the Way of South Africa. And by the Way of South Africa, he meant, and it's worth quoting him for what comes later and try to bear it in mind. He says, the establishment of an apartheid state with a settler minority lording it over a large exploited native majority. So one possibility was to create an apartheid state with a settler minority lording it over a large exploited native majority. That's one possibility. And the other possibility, he said, was the way of transfer, or what we nowadays call ethnic cleansing, to simply expel the indigenous population and in that way to resolve the dilemma. Those were really the only two options the Zionist movement had available to it. And during the first period of the conquest of Palestine, roughly you could say the years 1917 to 48, roughly speaking the interwar period, the period between World War I and World War II, the Zionist movement opted during that period for the expulsion of the indigenous population, the way of transfer. There's a large amount of documentation I can bring to bear to support that claim, but for our purposes, let's move on, and for those who would like the references, I can point them out to you during the questions and answers. The Zionist movement decided on expulsion, and the question for the Zionist movement was to get the timing right, because for someone like Ben-Gurion, the first Zionist leader within Palestine, and later the first prime minister of the state of Israel, he was a shrewd, ruthless politician. And he recognized, he said, there are kinds of things you can get away with in what he called normal times that you can't get away with in what he called revolutionary times. And the challenge was to be prepared for when the revolutionary times come, the abnormal times come, and then to use a current expression, you strike when the iron is hot. And he said, if you miss those opportunities, he says, a whole world is lost. Without going into a lengthy digression, it is true to say, and it's to the credit of the Zionist movement, that they were always very good, they were excellent, at exploiting very slender historical opportunities. You know, to use the old Marxist language, those slender historical opportunities, when the subjective factor becomes crucial. There are moments that come once, as Ben-Gurion said, and if you miss them, a whole world is lost. What was quite well done by the Zionist movement is when those moments came, and have come several times in the course of the history of the Zionist movement, when they did come, notably the issuance of the Balfour Declaration, the expulsion of the Arabs in 1948, the full conquest of Palestine in 1967. When the moment came, they were very prepared, and they maximized, as it were, the subjective factor. And they were very good at that, and one should acknowledge it. It was a question of excellent organization and a lot of ruthlessness. They were combined very well, and they achieved their goals. In any event, the Zionist movement opted for expulsion of the Palestinian Arab population. Right there, it clarifies a basic issue of the conflict, namely that Palestinian Arab resistance to Zionism had nothing whatever to do with an irrational hatred of Jews. It had nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It had nothing to do with any of those bogeys which are now brought into play to try to explain the Palestinian Arab opposition to Zionism. The opposition was very straightforward and very uncontroversial. They understood from the very beginnings of the Zionist movement that the success of the Zionist movement would be at their expense. So if you turn to Benny Morris, he writes at one point in his History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, he writes, "The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism." The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Well, it seems like a fairly uncontroversial statement, and you might wonder why I even bothered to repeat it. And yet it's a very striking statement. It metaphorically leaps off the page. Because what is he saying? Or I should say, what is he not saying? He is not saying the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism is anti-Semitism. He's not saying it's hatred of Jews. He's saying their resistance was completely understandable and comprehensible. It was the fear of territorial displacement and dispossession. And in any other conflict, if this conflict were not shrouded in this thick ideological fog, it would be perfectly understood. So, for example, if you take the case of the United States, if a historian tried to explain the resistance of Native Americans to European encroachment and said that they were motivated by anti-Europeanism, or they were motivated by anti-Christianism, or they were motivated by anti-whiteism, people would just laugh because it was perfectly obvious why Native Americans were resisting European encroachment. They feared their territorial displacement and dispossession. And yet something so transparent, so obvious, becomes so obscure and so occluded when you turn to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, it is true that the Zionist movement tried to claim that the resistance to the Zionist project was motivated by anti-Semitism, as Ben-Gurion said publicly, though never privately. Publicly, he would say that Jews were being murdered simply because they were Jews. And that served a useful ideological function, namely its aim was to conceal from the outside world the very legitimate and rational grievances of the Palestinian resistance. Thank you. also bears notice for what I'm going to say later, that Western European public opinion during this period, the interwar period, did not categorically oppose population expulsions as a means to resolve ethnic conflicts. There's a tendency, you know, understandable, to be skeptical about concepts like international law and international morality. But one shouldn't become so skeptical of them as to deny their, if I can use the word, efficacy in politics. They do have an effect. I'll try to illustrate this later, but for our purposes now, it's important to keep in mind that international law and international morality did, under extreme circumstances, acquiesce in, accept population transfers and expulsions. Some of you may know the most famous of this period was the population transfer expulsion exchange, whichever euphemism you want to use, between Turkey and Greece. About 1.5 million Greeks were expelled by Turkey, and then Greece expelled about 500,000 Turks. It was a very ugly affair, a very bloody affair, but public opinion, or I should say elite public opinion, came to regard the Turkish-Greek population exchange as a desirable precedent for resolving ethnic conflicts. I could cite many more examples. The one that concerns us here, it's important to keep in mind even the British Labour Party, which wasn't a radical party, but, you know, it's not the joke it is under Tony Blair. It did have, you know, leftist pretensions. The British Labour Party in 1944 supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine and their replacement by the Zionist colonists. And even the most notable moral figure of the first half of the 20th century, he played pretty much the equivalent role in the first half of the 20th century that Noam Chomsky has in the second half, namely Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell on non-European peoples, I've just spent the last few months going through a lot of his writing, on non-European peoples, he was pretty terrible. And he supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine. And generally, you know, reading him now, even though, you know, he's a great figure and a man of really awesome intellectual range. And he wasn't bad on the woman question. He's very similar to people like John Stuart Mill, who could be excellent on the woman question. The best part of the Western tradition, you know, the best part of it, people represented by like Mill and Russell, are very good in the woman question, but really quite awful on the non-white, non-European question, which I think suggests, though that's a digression, that the trying to extirpate racism is a much bigger challenge than trying to extirpate sexism. But that's another issue, can't go into it now. In any case, he was terrible, and he supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine. Yeah. And there's also the fact that American public opinion, almost across the board from the right to the left, for those of you who know the leftist tradition, you know, up to people like Henry Wallace, who was the left standard bearer during the 48 election, even from right to left, they all supported the Zionists and they all had contempt for the Arabs, basically because they operated from this paradigm that the Zionist movement represented progress, represented civilization, represented Western values, and they operate from the point of view that, well, I'll quote a British MP, Richard Crossman, he asked the question in a book he wrote in 1944, why is it that all Americans across the board show so complete disregard for the Arab case? And his answer was, it's worth listening, he says, Zionism, after all, is merely the attempt by the European Jew to build his national life on the soil of Palestine in much the same way as the American settler developed the West. So the American will give the Jewish settler in Palestine the benefit of the doubt and regard the Arab as the aboriginal, the indigenous population, who must go down before the march of progress. And I think it's a very accurate depiction of the mindset of the time. It's an interesting quote for two reasons. Number one, for those who've studied Euro-American conquest of the West, the analogy is pretty close. I've written on the topic. I compare the fate of the Palestinians with the fate of the Cherokee Indians. And the analogy is quite close. No analogies are perfect, but the similarities are resonant enough that the analogy is quite good. So number one, the analogy is right. If you want to understand what happened and what continues to happen to the Palestinians, look at the history of the conquest of the American West. The second reason the quote is quite interesting is the analogy is correct, but the moral value we attach to it is very different today. We no longer look at the Euro-American conquest of the West as an unmitigated good, and we no longer look at it merely as the march of progress. There's a totally different, not totally, but a substantially different moral mindset, and a very different moral judgment is rendered now than was rendered then about what happened to the native population in North America.
Yeah, that wood. عزيز 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 إيمان
يا عيني
يا يابي يا يابي لا من نال كل يلي ونحيي ألوجا ولا نمت نوم هني عزيز 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 أنا بخت الدود يا ابن آدم عظيمة يما
In any event, come 1948, the Zionist movement used the cover of war, the Revolutionary Times, used the cover of war to expel the indigenous population of Palestine. Basically, what they did in 1948 is what the Serbs did in 1999, using the cover of the NATO attack, in this case, using the cover of the Arab attack, to carry out long-held plans for expulsion. And by the end of the first Arab-Israeli War of 1948, about 80% of the indigenous population was expelled from the area that became the State of Israel. For those of you who are new to the topic, I always try, you know, to clarify issues for those who haven't read widely on the topic. Basically, 150,000 Palestinian Arabs are expelled from the area that becomes Israel. And those 750,000 Arabs become what we now call the refugee question, the Palestinian refugee question. Many went to live in refugee camps in what came to be called the West Bank in Gaza. Others went to live in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria, and elsewhere. So when you hear references to the Palestinian refugee question, you're hearing references basically, but not entirely, but basically the Palestinians who were expelled in 1948 and now their children and grandchildren. Israel, the state of Israel that was created in 1948, encompassed approximately 80% of what's called British-mandated Palestine, and the areas that did not come under Israeli control are the areas that we now call the West Bank and Gaza. So when people refer to the State of Israel, they're referring to the borders that were created in 1948 at the end of the war, which comprised about 80% of Palestine.
Le surréalisme est évidemment vivant. Ses créateurs même ne sont pas encore morts. Des gens nouveaux, de plus en plus médiocres, il est vrai, s'en réclament. Le surréalisme est connu du grand public comme l'extrême du modernisme et, d'autre part, il est devenu objet de jugement universitaire. Il s'agit bien d'une de ces choses qui vivent en même temps que nous, comme le catholicisme et le général de Gaulle. La véritable question est alors, quel est le rôle du surréalisme aujourd'hui ? La L'activité surréaliste, malgré son intention fondamentale de changer la vie, a eu sa principale application dans l'art et l'écriture poétique. Un jugement sur le sens du surréalisme est donc un jugement de la culture moderne et des modifications survenues à travers le mouvement historique particulier du surréalisme, le mouvement général de la culture, leur interaction. Le dadaïsme peut être considéré comme le moment de la fin de la culture dominante, de la culture bourgeoise. On a justement souligné que Dada n'était pas, ainsi qu'il est parfois activement défini, un produit direct du premier conflit mondial. Quelques courants spécifiquement dadaïstes avaient paru dans l'avant-guerre. Le premier conflit mondial et Dada sont plutôt deux produits contemporains des contradictions extrêmes d'une société. La destruction dadaïste, prise de conscience de l'épuisement des superstructures culturelles que nous connaissons, n'en marque pas pour autant la disparition pratique. Aussi longtemps que l'irremplaçable critique des armes n'aura pas ruiné l'infrastructure économique d'exploitation, une sorte de post-faste culturel survivra dans la répétition. Cependant, les nouvelles forces productives condamnent, avec les anciens rapports de production, tout le spectacle culturel qui les accompagnait. Il faut maintenant chercher à réaliser des constructions supérieures de notre milieu et des événements de notre vie, au niveau du développement matériel de l'époque, au niveau de son progrès dans la domination de la nature. Les recherches dans cette perspective sont objectivement inséparables de l'entreprise de transformation révolutionnaire du monde. Le surréalisme, qui s'est constitué immédiatement après la crise dadaïste, avec la volonté de passer à une action positive, a-t-il su répondre à de tels besoins ? Dès l'origine, il y a dans le surréalisme, qui par là est comparable au romantisme, un antagonisme entre les tentatives d'affirmation d'un nouvel usage de la vie et une fuite réactionnaire hors du réel. Le côté progressif du surréalisme à son début est dans sa revendication d'une liberté totale et dans quelques essais d'intervention dans la vie quotidienne. Supplément à l'histoire de l'art. Le surréalisme est dans le champ de la culture comme l'ombre du personnage absent dans un tableau de Quirico. Il donne à voir le manque d'un avenir nécessaire. Le côté rétrograde du surréalisme s'est manifesté d'emblée par la surestimation de l'inconscient et sa monotone exploitation artistique. L'idéalisme dualiste qui tente à comprendre l'histoire comme simple opposition entre les précurseurs de l'irrationnel surréaliste et la tyrannie des conceptions logiques gréco-latines. La participation à cette propagande bourgeoise qui présente l'amour comme la seule aventure possible dans les conditions modernes d'existence. Cette ambivalence du surréalisme a duré une dizaine d'années seulement. La pression des circonstances extérieures, particulièrement une régression de la Révolution mondiale et la réussite d'un art surréaliste, entraîna dans ce délai le triomphe des caractères rétrogrades à l'intérieur du surréalisme. Le surréalisme aujourd'hui est parfaitement ennuyeux et réactionnaire. L'irrationnel qui a servi quelque temps contre les valeurs logiques dominantes sert à présent l'irrationalité dominante d'un régime toujours plus décomposé, dont la confusion est l'arme idéologique primordiale. L'occultisme, la magie, la platitude humoristique, la passion d'un insolite toujours pareil à lui-même sont les déchets dont le
All has been psychedelicized. Time.
I told him to go up there.
Everybody says look up there.
Not with earphones on. I.
How many times do I have to tell him?
All right, everybody has to have earphones.
Janice will be happy to learn that I remain, as I approach my 50th birthday, I remain a communist, and I believe in a world without any states. I don't see any need for states. I think we have to take Rodney King's credo and learn how to get along, not just in the United States, but all over the world. So I'm not keen on states as a personal preference, but, you know, those are personal preferences. And then we have to be sort of take into account reality. And if we're moral actors, the most important reality we have to take into account is maximizing, or should, let me reverse the formulation, to as much as it is in our power to minimize the suffering of the people there. The suffering is terrible, and the suffering is now generations long. My own view is, before you have a single state in Palestine, Israel will have to undergo such radical changes that if you now start calling for one state in Palestine for Jews and Arabs, you're basically writing off this generation and the next generation of Palestinians. I don't have it in me to do that. I know all the people, but I have enough friends there that I'm not ready to write off their lives and the lives of their children unless I am absolutely 100% certain that there is no possibility the two-state settlement and a full Israeli withdrawal can happen. I still think it's possible. I admit it's a small possibility. I still think it's possible there can be effected a full Israeli withdrawal. I admit it's a small possibility, but I still think it's there. If it proves...
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.